Mr. Kubowski.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. We are here on the case of Michael Walsh versus David Heilemann in the Village of Oak Lawn. Mr. Walsh was employed as a hearing officer for the Village of Oak Lawn, and in that capacity, he heard traffic violation citation cases and similar non-vehicular ordinance violations. That is to say, he heard oaths, he heard evidence, he determined whether the evidence supported a finding that the cited person had violated the ordinance, and if so, applied a fine from a schedule of fines that was set forth in the ordinance previously adopted by the municipality.
What sorts of non-vehicular code violations are covered under the hearing officer's duties? I mean, what I did was I glanced at the village's municipal code, and it looks like the non-vehicular hearing officer would issue fines related to business regulations, consumer fraud, public amusements, peddlers, taxis, building codes, public health and sanitation. Now, if those are the areas that are covered, how could that hearing officer not be considered a policymaker?
Well, I'm somewhat constrained in answering that question because of the procedural posture of this case. This is on an appeal from the dismissal of a complaint, so there is no factual record where any of that was brought out at the trial court.
Right.
So there's nothing in the record I can point to on that. I do obviously have some knowledge of the case and can go into that, but I thought I should point out that procedural issue before I do.
Yeah, I thought the hearing officer's duties are statutory to the extent that they relate to non-vehicle code. Isn't that right?
The duties are set forth in the ordinance, and to some degree that's authorized. That ordinance was in turn authorized by statute.
It's not a factual question in that sense. Right. We just look at the statute and we look at the ordinance.
The hearing officer is indeed applying the terms of the ordinance, determining whether somebody perhaps has a license would be a typical kind of non-vehicular case.
Well, but see, here's why I was concerned about, you know, and why I ask you this question. Because the maximum fine for vehicular violations is $250. But non-vehicular violations, it is $50,000. And there's a lot of room for discretion and judgment and setting policy, it would seem, $50,000, wow. I mean, why wouldn't that alone be enough to make him a policymaker?
Well, I have two answers to that. Once again, I'm constrained by the record. And in reality, he was not imposing fines up to that level. Mr. Walsh, under the system set forth in the Oak Lawn ordinances, essentially had a supervisor. There was a courtroom administrator that, at least for certain of his aspects, had a review capacity on the decisions. And even for the non-vehicular issues, there are certain of the ordinances have their own schedule of fines and maximums that are quite a bit less than $50,000.
But I guess the point is, whether he did or didn't, he could.
Subject to review by superiors at the village. Again, we don't have a record to show exactly what the policies and directions there were on that and what fines were imposed. I don't believe he ever was in a position to award fines of anywhere near that level. My understanding is the types of non-vehicular code violations that he was hearing were such things as somebody who didn't have a proper business license, things of that nature. I hope I've answered your question.
But there is a
second category of answer to that, and in that, like any adjudicative hearing officer, he is applying facts and law, and the precedents that are in this circuit, as well as others, perhaps with the exception of the Sixth Circuit, state that a purely adjudicative role, which would involve assessing a penalty, is inherently not policymaking. It's the general standard, of course, is that firing for political reasons is not permitted, and the exception that was briefed by the parties, and I think that everybody involved in this case who's read the briefs comes to, is this a policymaking position? Because that would be the only possible exception that the defendants could rely on to get around the general rule that employees may not be fired for their political beliefs. And the Thompson case and the Roldan-Plumy case, both from this circuit and both relatively recently, to some extent touch on this. The Thompson case, I think, is particularly illustrative on this point, where the court was considering a chief administrative law judge for the Department of Professional Regulation in Illinois, and it divided up the roles of that administrator into a category that it said was 85% of his role and a category that it said was 15% of his role. The 85% was advising superiors on policy and setting rules and communicating with the public and a wide range of supervisory and rule-setting and rule-making tasks. The 15% of this particular person's role was the adjudicative part, and the court was fairly clear that if that had been his role, if he'd been limited to the 15% of essentially functioning as a hearing officer, that would not be a policymaking role. It was the 85% that led to the plaintiff in the Thompson case being found to be a policymaking employee, not the 15% that was adjudicative. There's wisdom in the distinction that this and other courts have long made between the legislative bodies, which are normally referred to as the policy-making bodies, and the court system and adjudicative officers who are generally considered to be non-political and non-policy-making bodies. That's why deference is given to...
Why do you say a judge who has the discretion to choose a fine anywhere between $0 and $50,000 is not making policy? One might think that choice is the polity's choice.
It's within a constrained range. Every employee that exercises professional or other...
constrained to $50,000, but is it constrained in how the judge does it?
Again, I'm constrained by the limited nature of the record here. We never got to the facts.
This isn't a record question. This is a question about the local statutes or the ordinances. What do they say? Do they constrain what this administrative law judge can do?
The constraints are much clearer on the traffic side of his role. He essentially filled two offices. One was vehicular and had one set of ordinances, and one was non-vehicular and had another.
Traffic rules appear to be highly rule-bound. But are there any rules, any biting rules with respect to the 0 to 50,000 range?
It is not absolute, because certain of the specific violations, if you look to the ordinances that actually are being adjudicated, do have limits that are much, much more restrained than the $50,000.
Some do, some don't. And this particular office has jurisdiction over both. That's why I'm asking it. It doesn't seem to me one gets to be not a policymaker if 50% of your job is non-policymaking and the other 50% is. That's why we need to concentrate on the discretionary area. But my question is, are there, as a matter of local law, any constraints on where in that range one sets?
There are, Your Honor, for many of the types of individual ordinances that are being applied. It's my understanding that very few of the actual types of cases that reached this hearing officer's desk would have been something where he was able to award something in the $50,000 range.
Is he authorized to accept pleas? Guilty pleas, no contest pleas?
The plea arrangement was actually in the hands of the administrator. There was unlike perhaps most of the precedents that are similar in dealing with adjudicative type roles, there was an administrator in both settings, in both the traffic and the non-vehicular settings, that had many of the powers that one would normally think of as being given to a judge. It does not appear, in fact, it appears clearly from the ordinance that he didn't even have inherent rulemaking power to run his own courtroom. The rules were set by this superior official that was given the title of administrator in both settings. And a lot of the plea issues and similar types of matters that might be brought before a judge in the state court system or in the federal system were in the hands of someone else, rulemaking and dealing with such matters as pleas.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Trubosky. Mr. Penrose.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My colleague's arguments are insightful, but they seem to all address the wrong question from our perspective. These arguments all seem to be keyed on whether Mr. Walsh, as an administrative law judge, was making a policy decision on a village-wide basis, like a trustee promulgating ordinances, rules, budgets. We believe the Supreme Court and this Court has not construed this First Amendment test as narrowly as my colleague, but a lot more broader. Yes?
Are the vehicular hearing officer and the non-vehicular hearing officer always the same person? In other words, are those jobs severable in the village of Oak Lawn? And I ask because it's possible that one was a policy-making position, the other was not.
I suppose it's possible, Your Honor. I believe Mr. Walsh is, and my colleague could certainly address this, but I believe Mr. Walsh is being like the only person who's actually done it since the ordinance were drafted in 99, early 2000. Our position is the differences between the non-vehicular, vehicular, you could certainly say there's a difference in the monetary amounts, but if you drill down to what exactly the judge is doing, it's the same thing. He's listening to evidence and he's making decisions, and those decisions are whether or not individuals or entities, businesses, owe money to the village. That's, in our view, is a governmental decision by any stretch of the imagination. Now, admittedly, vehicular violations, we're talking about $250, so that's obviously different than $50,000, but the process involved is the same. He's listening to people present their stories, and he's making a decision. And in all fairness, there is, in the vehicular scenario, there is a small, what I would call an administrative review, but however, that administrative review is not in the nature of a recommendation. The administrator, him or herself, has only narrow powers to set aside a fine imposed by Mr. Walsh. And even if they do, that's not a decision. It goes back and they start the process over. And those types of situations are, number one, it's not automatic. The person who parked illegally or what have you has to file something with the administrator within 14 days. And the administrator, him or herself, only has three areas where they can actually set aside, and it has nothing to do with the merits. It has to do with whether or not the person who received the citation, it's not their vehicle, or the person already paid, or third, whether or not there was excusable neglect, so to speak, for not showing up at the original hearing.
Well, if I were someone who believed that anyone in a village who, whether he did or didn't, had the right to inflict $50,000 on fine on another person. I mean, that's a policymaker, isn't it?
I would agree, absolutely, 100%. But I wouldn't say that $50,000 is a determinative question. It certainly would make it more likely. But I think it's his duties that you really have to focus on in terms of what's going on here. I hope that answers your question.
Well, I mean, it just seems to me, I mean, if he was simply the hearing officer for vehicular municipal code violations and not for the non-vehicular matters, I mean, he surely wouldn't be a policymaker in that capacity. I mean, parking violations, city stickers, you know, these are ministerial actions.
I would say that probably not, because the hearings are going to be issues that the person who got the citation says, wait a second, I wasn't in that spot. Or perhaps the huge tree on ABC Avenue so covering up the handicapped parking that I couldn't see it, and the police officer theoretically would come in and say, Your Honor, this citation was issued in November. There are no leaves on the trees, so I would suggest to the court that even in those limited situations, there could still be a situation where Mr. Walsh's administrative law judge could be making credibility determinations.
Yeah, but is credibility in this situation the same as policy? I mean,
policy not as a village trustee, but policy in the to the extent that the Kitty Brown case talks about meaningful input into governmental decision making, and this is clearly
well. Then every police officer on the street is a policy making.
Except they're whether someone or not is arrested, that does not decide the issues from a village perspective. Here, Mr. Walsh's final decisions are debts owed to the municipality, short of someone appealing. And the situation is you run down, for instance, if there were no ordinance, these would be in front of a judge in Cook County, probably one of the sub-circuits. So from that standpoint, he's doing identically what a judge who this court and the Supreme Court has said is on a policy-making level. So just because he is determining, say, smaller amounts or maybe less factually complex, he's still the final arbiter of a governmental decision, whether it's $250 or not. And the district court points out a good point that this would be exactly the type of position where maybe the mayor ran on a cracking down on illegal parking violation. We don't know that, but it's not whether the fact is, it's whether it's a possibility. And this could certainly be something that a mayor could run on a platform of cracking down on violation breakers, whether it's a code violation or a parking violation. So you would want someone even in that situation of issuing decisions, debts to the municipality on parking, whether the amounts at issue, you'd still want someone of a like mind, whether it's political, whether it's some other faction, you want to be of like mind, because there is so much discretion involved in terms of whether to issue the fine itself.
The jurisdiction of the hearing officer over non-vehicle code violations extends to the entire universe of municipal code violations?
That's my understanding, yes, Your Honor. That's at least there's nothing in this record to demonstrate that, and I have no personal knowledge of any kind of code violations that he could not render, assuming that it went through the proper channels, there was a violation, hearing notice, et cetera, et cetera.
And what do the municipal ordinances or state statutes say about the hearing officer's authority to accept pleas?
It doesn't really say anything. Again, from a practical standpoint, I would assume if a business got hit with a code violation and they realized they were issued, they would just pay it to the county clerks, who would never get to Mr. Walsh. I think Mr. Walsh was really dealing with contested issues.
A lot of plea bargaining goes on in municipal court, right?
Oh, absolutely. Oh,
that's what my question is directed
at. Right.
And plea bargaining is clearly a policy matter.
Oh, right? Sure, absolutely. And I would posit if the violator came to the court and said, Your Honor, how about X amount of dollars? And I would say there's nothing to prohibit it from doing that other than
right.
some of these other ordinances that say you can only do it within these amounts.
Happens all the time in
yes.
traffic court.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
That's what my question is directed at.
Yes,
does
there's
this
nothing
plaintiff else. Hearing officer or former hearing officer have authority to do that, or is
yes.
that not clear in the ordinances?
I would argue that he has final
well,
authority.
I'm not asking for an argument. I'm asking for what the ordinance says.
Or the ordinance says he has final decision-making ability with respect to violations, and I would say that that subsumes exactly what you're talking about here.
Okay.
The other issue was really not raised, but just to touch on the qualified immunity analysis as to the mayor himself. When we look at these decisions, including the Kurowski case of this court, we would argue that if a reasonable person looking down at those decisions, and they've all been cited in my brief, that what Mr. Walsh did and what these people are doing are exactly the same thing. So it would be reasonable for the mayor and the trustees who actually made this decision to rely upon those decisions on a qualified immunity analysis. If I don't have any other questions to respond to, I will conclude my argument here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.